Walk through those barriers.
And quickly, in anticipation that another member comes through the door.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell, Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and the bill before you is a consensus bill. We worked with the State Court Administrator's Office, and we come here together to support this.
All right, and what does the bill do?
The bill basically takes care of an issue that was created last session by a bill which actually allowed district court judges to determine who could carry firearms into court facilities. This was a concern to the law enforcement community because of the potential for differing orders from county to county. And so in working with the State Court Administrator's Office, our interest was to authorize law enforcement officers to carry into a court facility with the following three caveats. One, that they do so while officially on duty. We were concerned that law enforcement officers who are themselves a part of a domestic dispute or other dispute that they might personally be involved in, we weren't wanting to create a situation where they were authorized to carry their firearms into the court facility. They also were to carry the firearm issued to them by their employing agency, and that they would abide by any plans.
Say that last thing again?
They
would carry the firearm what?
Just issued to them by their employing agency.
Well, what if your agency doesn't issue your firearm?
Or authorized. And then the third piece of that was that in carrying a weapon into a court facility, they would do so within the parameters of any court security plan that's developed by the committee that would do that in the county that where they're entering a court facility.
You mean we're not supposed to surprise them?
What's that?
We're not supposed to surprise them.
Well, the example I gave earlier was that, or to some that I talked to during the floor session today, was that if you're an undercover police officer, some security plans might ask you to wear a name badge while you're carrying into court facility. It does have to be noticed, so the law enforcement officer would know going in what the requirements are, but we were fine with that. Our main concern was that in the bill that was passed last session, there was a potential, if a court order prohibited a law enforcement officer from carrying into a court facility and they did so, they'd be subject potentially to a C felony. And so we were working to try to create something that could be a statewide expectation that we could all live with, and the State Court Administrator's Office graciously worked with us to create the bill that's before you now.
Okay, and everybody's happy, right? Okay. Work session, 2409.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2409 engrossed to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2409 and goes to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. And Carrier. Senator Harper.
Good. Senator Bridges. You should carry.
Yeah. Representative Shadley is here. He was fine. I feel like he's.
Which one, James?
Finally, vote. He's here on this one.
Okay, public hearing 2413. Representative Shetterly.
That's the carry bill, sorry. It's them.
They're following.
Mr. Chair, you must have a stocking bill up. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Lane Shetterly, State Representative, District 34. Let me explain to you why I am sponsoring a bill that expands the affirmative defense to a charge of furnishing obscene materials to minors. It sounds like something you might not want to do when you look at it that way, but the reason is this. In a recent Court of Appeals case, State versus Maynard, the court held that the statute that creates the crime, furnishing obscene materials to minors, is unconstitutionally broad. And let me just explain. And so as a result, the court held that prosecution may not be brought under that statute, so effectively has overturned the statute that we have in ORS 167065, furnishing obscene materials. If I may, I've got about a page and a half that I will read because it's complicated enough that if I don't, I will lose myself. In State versus Maynard, the Court of Appeals held that the furnishing obscene materials to minors statute violates the free speech clause of the Oregon Constitution as an overbroad limitation on expression because it permits prosecution regardless of the significance of the sexual depictions in the content of the materials taken as a whole. And in doing that, it reaches conduct that's protected by the Constitution as free speech. For instance, in the statute, it says a person commits the crime of furnishing if the person furnishes to a minor a picture that depicts nudity. Well, that would include an illustration in an art book. And so the Court of Appeals said, no, that's too broad. We're not going to allow a prosecution under that statute. Now, the state, in the Maynard case, tried to save the statute furnishing obscene materials to minors by reference to the statute that's amended in House Bill 2413, which provides for affirmative defenses to the charge.
How did he like this?
And in that statute, which is in the bill, ORS 167.085, Representative Courtney, this is
Senator
complicated.
Courtney, Senator Courtney would like you to kind of back up, regroup, and try to reduce this to some extremely simple terms for...
It's very difficult to do it in very simple terms, because the Court of Appeal, the state said, well, okay, if you look at the statute that's in the bill, it says the defendant, if you look in sub on line 11 of the bill, it says it is an affirmative defense that the defendant was charged with the sale, et cetera, of an item that might otherwise be contraband. So the state said, well, you can save the underlying statute by reference to the affirmative defense, but the court said, no, you can't, because furnishing is not the same thing as selling. So if you give a book with a picture of of nudity in it, that's not saved by this affirmative defense. And so what this bill does is it ties the language of the affirmative defense directly to the language of the statute, which is the, here's the nut of it. This is what the Court of Appeals said would have to be done in order to make the furnishing obscene materials to minors statute constitutional. So this bill follows the recipe that was laid out by the Court of Appeals in how to make the furnishing obscene materials to minors statute constitutional so that prosecutions can be brought under it again. Now, my good friends behind me, who have been making faces as I speak, Mr. Fedanke and Ms. Meyer, oppose this bill because not really so much because what the bill does, but they think that the whole section of the statutes relating to obscene materials is just hopelessly unconstitutional. It's not so much that they oppose what this bill does as they think that more needs to be done with this whole area of the statutes. I guess my response to that would be, number one, could be, but I think it's an interim project. It's broader than we have. We even tried to do that over on the House side, and everything we fixed just created more questions. So there's no, we don't have the time right now to do that. I think you don't either on this side. So I think that's an interim project to look at the whole collection of statutes here relating to obscenity. And number two, this is the fix that the Court of Appeals prescribed for the legislature to make to save this statute, furnishing obscene materials to minor. If Mr. Fedanke wants to make the next challenge to suggest to the court that this is still unconstitutional on some other grounds, I guess he's, you know, he's welcome to do that. But I think the response will be that this is the repair to the statute that the Court of Appeals invited the legislature to make. So that's why we are doing it. We are expanding the affirmative defense in order to save the underlying statute from the constitutional infirmity that was identified by the court in the Maynard case.
Why did this not go to the Supreme Court?
I don't know whether review was sought or whether it might have been sought and review denied. It's discretionary on the Supreme Court whether to take a case. Frankly, I think I'd be surprised if review was sought. I think that under the statutes, it's the correct result.
I actually got my hands on a copy of the Maynard case, and I mean, for a non-lawyer, I think for lawyers, it's confusing, very confusing. I think the minimalist approach might be the best way to go.
No, this is the minimalist approach.
So, all right, Representative, thank you very much.
Anybody
have any questions? And I don't know, does the committee understand kind of the history of what's happened since 1987, State versus Henry? Free speech, Oregon. Basically, everything's speech, pretty much.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what we're wrestling with. This is the one of the aftershocks of State versus Henry. But I think we, and that, I think, Henry, State versus Henry, really is part of the reason that it's hard for us to get back in the middle of this session and fix all of these obscenity statutes, because State versus Henry affects quite a number of statutes that are in this section of the ORS, and I really do believe that that's a worthwhile interim project to try to do that. And when we did try, Mr. Fedanke, I'm sure will be able to tell you that we ran through four or five amendments on the House side trying to fix this, but it was just too complicated to get done in the middle of the session. So I'll commit to working with them in the interim to try and do the bigger fix, but this is the minimalist approach, to use the chair's language, to at least fix this one statute according to the outline laid out by the Court of Appeals in its own opinion, which declared the statute unconstitutional.
Any idea why it took them so many pages to say that?
I think they found it a very interesting intellectual exercise.
I'm trying to, the statute that's referenced here is 167.085, mm-hmm. And that is...
That'd be also in the bill, too.
Yeah, okay. But that's defense of prosecution of under.
6.5. Mr. Chairman?
Oh, 6.5, yeah.
Oh, 6.5, that's right.
Can I ask something?
Sure, go ahead.
Chair, members of the committee, I think we may help clarify this issue, too, is that, for example, now, if a person sold a 17-year-old picture of Michelangelo's David as part of an art book, that would be protected by the statutory defense. But if the same person gave the same book as a Christmas present, it would not be. And this is basically what the change does.
And that's why the court said that the affirmative defense statute doesn't save the underlying statute, because it will not be criminal to give a 17-year-old an art book that contains a picture of the Michelangelo's David.
And I think part of the problem, too, though, is if you read through 167.065, the furnishing obscene materials to minors, it is a crime if certain things are, I guess, exposed to or provided for.
Right.
A minor, just a prima facie case. It is what it is, without any intent on behalf of the person who provides the material. And that really is kind of the crux of the issue here.
Well, I guess if you look at, though, Mr. Chair, in sub 1 at the very beginning of the statute, they do have the standard of knowing or have reason to know, at least of the character of the material.
Yeah, but that's the issue, though. I mean, it's knowing or having good reason to know that the character of the material furnished the person furnishes to the minor, and then goes on to delineate that. But I guess looking back at the issue, I think we can get to constitutional approval when we include some form of mental intent on behalf of the actor. Don't you think? I mean, that we would bypass any incidental.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think you can only go so far that direction. The free speech clause will protect free speech regardless, I think, of intent.
Well, but if the person intends to provide the material for the purpose of facilitating their own abuse or potential abuse or engagement in the production of particular, the so-called grooming kind of processes that a lot of child sexual offenders, sex abusers go through, the preferential child molesters.
Mr. Chair, that actually was the direction of one of the amendments we were looking at on the House side, to revamp this to what I think we were looking at, a statute making it a crime to groom. It was basically a grooming statute, using this kind of activity for the purpose of grooming. But then we got bogged down in definitions and statutory references and cross-references within this section, and that was part of the problem when we just ran out of gas, running out of time for House bills over there, because it does get complicated. But actually, it could very well be a direction that the interim committee may want to go, looking more at the purpose to which these materials are being provided.
Right.
I will say, too, it's clear that if you look just at, and this is what the state tried to do in the Maynard case, if you look just at 167.065, it is clearly overbroad. They tried to save it by reference to this statute that's in the bill, which is the affirmative defense statute, and say, well, you may be charged under 165, but in fact it's not an offense if you come within this affirmative defense. And so the affirmative defense saves the constitutional problems in 065. And in this case, it did not, because in 065, it uses the word furnishing, and in the affirmative defense statute, it uses the word sale. And the court said they're not the same thing, so you can it is still overbroad even by reference to the affirmative defense.
Okay. Any questions? None. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. And who's next here? David Fedanke. Would you two like to sit together, or would you like to go back?
I'm sorry, these chairs are occupied.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Tedanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon. I have distributed some written testimony, but I won't read it. As Representative Shetterly explained, this area of the law is fairly complicated. I will try to keep it as simple as possible. ORS 167.065, which is the underlying statute furnishing obscene materials to minors, was adopted in 1971 as part of the Comprehensive Criminal Code revision. And that date is very important because at that time, the U.S. Supreme Court standard for criminal statutes that prohibited obscenity was Roth versus United States. Prior to Miller versus California, which was decided in 1973. So this language in the affirmative defense that is contained in House Bill 2413 is based on obsolete First Amendment case law under the federal Constitution. This statute has been attacked repeatedly over the years in the context of criminal prosecutions. The first case decided by the Oregon Court of Appeals was in 1982, State versus Frink, which held that the portion of the statute which prohibits furnishing a minor any material which contains nudity was overbroad. So the section in 167.065, which prohibits providing material that contains any nudity to a minor, was held unconstitutional in 1982. No change to the statute was made following that decision. In 1985, a second decision was handed down by the Oregon Court of Appeals. Again, and this is all prior to State versus Henry in 1987, which dealt with the portion of the statute in ORS 167.065, Section 1, Subsection B, that prohibits providing to any minor material which contains obscenities. And obscenities are defined in ORS 167.060 as those slang words currently generally rejected for regular use in mixed society, and then it goes on from there. Clearly overbroad. That provision of the law has remained unchanged despite having been held unconstitutional. Along comes State versus Maynard, which has gone through several evolutions. It was decided once by the Oregon Court of Appeals, appealed to the Oregon Supreme Court, and remanded back to the Oregon Court of Appeals after the Oregon Supreme Court upheld the child pornography statute in State versus Stoneman. And as Representative Shetterly has explained, in dealing with the first constitutional issue, which is whether or not the statute includes material which is protected by the Constitution, that is, whether or not the statute is too broad, the court looked to this affirmative defense provision. And I want to emphasize, this is not an exception to the criminal law. This comes into play after a person has been arrested and is being prosecuted for furnishing material which may be constitutionally protected. They are brought into court, and at that point, the defense can raise one of these affirmative defenses. Now, the foundation that Representative Shetterly wants you to build upon is this subsection 3 of ORS 167.085, which again is based on a standard that the U.S. Supreme Court laid out prior to 1971. You have access to this defense if the material, portions of which might otherwise be contraband, form merely an incidental part of an otherwise non-offending whole and serve some legitimate purpose therein other than titillation. I respectfully disagree with Representative Shetterly, who I have great respect for, in saying that this, when he says that this is going to fix this statute. Because the issue that the Court of Appeals did not get to, because they found that the statute was overbroad, was whether or not the statute was too vague to pass muster under either the Oregon Constitution or the federal Constitution. And I would submit to you that this language in subsection 3 is inherently vague, and there is no chance that it will withhold constitutional attack under either the Oregon Bill of Rights or the federal Constitution. And because of that, we believe that you should reject this bill and pick up either during the interim or right now where the House Judiciary Committee left off with the proposal that we suggested as an alternative, which would establish the crime of grooming a minor for unlawful sexual activity, grooming being the attempt to predispose a minor to engage in unlawful sexual activity. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Courtney.
Yeah, I'm just curious, Senator and High Counsel Taylor, this legislature has, I think, Mr. Chair, on three different occasions placed a ballot measure on the, ballot that attempted to amend the Oregon Constitution so communities, cities would have it, the ability to zone adult bookstores where they've constantly been frustrated. And I think Representative Patrick did it last session, as he took the lead, again on the ballot, again failed. Are we dealing with the same part of the Constitution here in this
area?
Yes,
Mr. Chairman.
Same part.
Yes. I think, and Mr. Vedanke can probably describe this better than I can, what you're talking about at the federal level, the federal Constitution is applying the balancing test. So what you here have in Oregon is something that's more absolute under Henry.
Ms. Chair and Senator Courtney.
No, that's all right, Mr. Vedanke. I hear from you a lot. and you know what really hurts? You know what really hurts? You know what he did? He disagrees. I strongly agree with Representative Lane Shelley, for whom I have great respect.
Yeah.
This man's been disagreeing with me for 9 sessions on my bills, but he's never added. I strongly disagree with Representative Courtney, Senator Courtney, for whom I have great, for whom he has never been there. So at least, Lane, you ought to feel good about that. He's got respect for you.
I feel great.
None for me, baby. So I have no sympathy for what you're going through, Lane. I thought I just said it there. So.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
I think what I would suggest, you can do with this bill what you want. It's not a take-home bill for me. I don't have anyone back in the district waiting for this, but I think it's in measured steps, I think it's the right thing to do this session because it's in front of us. I think what Mr. Vedanke is basically arguing, he's making a legal argument to you, I think, as if you were the court on the next at the next level of argument. And we're not there. The court had this statute in front of them. And the court in 80 pages or however many pages they wrote in this opinion, Mr. Chair, you saw the opinion, identified what the constitutional infirmity was here and how the legislature could address that. I think we are taking the court at face value in its opinion. And again, if this statute is subject to challenge on some other grounds, our choice is one of two things, either to shy away from taking that issue on entirely and leaving our criminal code without a statute relating to the furnishing of obscene materials to minors for the next 2 years or 2.5 years until we can get a bill passed and into law, or at least applying the remedy that the Court of Appeals expressly invited us to apply to salvage the statute and then work on a larger, broader fix in the interim.
If you go to 163.686, encouraging child sexual abuse in the second degree, it says that a person commits a crime of encouraging child sexual abuse in the second degree if the person knowingly possesses or controls any photograph, motion picture, videotape, or other visual recording or sexually explicit conduct involving the child for the purpose of arousing or satisfying the sexual desires of the person. So I guess my question is, we could pass the bill as it is, have the various appeals and let the court go through that machination. We could repeal the statute. And your statement about there not being anything left, I mean, there is a criminal statute here where it includes for the purposes of, kind of gets to the intent issue.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that this one doesn't get at furnishing just gets that possession.
Right, but for a specific purpose. They knowingly possess control, photograph, blah, 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 well, actually, that's involving a child, as opposed to simply supplying or providing it to a child.
Yeah, okay. This gets at possessing child pornography, I think, more than furnishing anything to a minor.
Okay, great. Well, yes, sir.
So, President Shelley, you don't, obviously you don't agree that you need to amend the Constitution to deal with the issue.
Yeah, I think you can make the statute work, Mr. Chair, Representative Senator Courtney. I think you can make these statutes work within the Constitution without having to amend it. And in fact, what the court in Henry did was prescribe just how to do that. It didn't say that we needed to amend the Constitution. It said, within this constitutional framework, if you want to fix this statute, here is what you need to do. And that's what this bill does. It's very narrowly tailored to address the Court of Appeals' stated objections and the way out of the thicket in the Henry opinion.
All right.
Senator. Could you say a little bit more about your recommended approach, the grooming statute, and whether it has a bill number, where it is, and why you feel that that would not have the constitutional problems that this approach has?
Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, the proposal that we put forward, I probably should have provided copies to the committee today, but I certainly can make them available, would have been similar to the section of law that the chair just referenced, except that it would have related to any material. I'll only just read it briefly. A person commits the crime of grooming a child for unlawful sexual activity if the person knowingly furnishes to a child under 16 years of age any visual depiction of sexually explicit conduct for the purpose of predisposing the child to engage in unlawful sexual activity. We believe that by combining the furnishing with the purpose for which it is furnished, you meet the standards that are required under the Oregon Bill of Rights, and we believe that the statute in Chapter 163 and the definitions there are tight enough and the exceptions from the law are tight enough that you will avoid any overbreath problems and also avoid vagueness problems. Whereas trying to build on the shaky foundation of Chapter 167, we believe, is an exercise in futility. And again, I want to emphasize, not just under the Oregon Bill of Rights, but under the federal Constitution as well, because it is based on an outdated federal standard, which is no longer good law.
Could I ask Representative Shetterly what his...
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick. I think, and this was the direction we were going, I think it represents a good start for the interim. I think there were some definitional issues that we got into in this and looking at unlawful sexual activity and referencing other portions of these obscenity statutes that themselves raise questions as to how broad or overbroad or vague they are. And so it kind of led us down this path as we referenced these other sections of the statute of having to look at amending those in light of State versus Henry. And frankly, I think that's where the weight of this got to be more than the House Judiciary Committee was really ready to take on. It's a good start, and I think that for an interim project, it's the way to go. I'm just concerned that about leaving a gap in the statutes for the next 2.5 years until we make this broader fix. As long as we have a path outlined to us by the Court of Appeals, I'm willing to take that and let the court say that it didn't mean what it said in Henry or that it meant more, just didn't say so. We can take that chance. I'll leave that to good folks like Mr. Penn to decide whether they want to bring prosecutions under the statute in light of Mr. Fidanky's objections. But in the, you know, so that takes care of it, I think, for the short term. In the long term, I think this is a very good way to go. I'm happy to work with Dave and his group in the interim.
Mr. Chair, one last fact that may be important to the committee. My understanding is that a petition for review is still pending in State versus Maynard, that the Oregon Supreme Court has not acted on that petition yet.
Okay, I want to kind of just for my own understanding, what exactly is the problem we're trying to fix? and the intent of the statute as it was originally created in 1971 tried to prohibit a particular kind of circumstance, and help me understand exactly what that is. And I want to talk about it because I want to talk about whether or not that in and of itself is constitutional under the current scheme. In other words, you have a particular piece of material that would otherwise be obscene being given to a minor.
Right.
Those materials, because of the content, are protected under Article 1, Section 8 of our Constitution, Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution. But it's the issue of providing those materials to a minor, and I'm kind of trying to remember back having read the Stoneman case a few years ago where, you know, it talked about a compelling state interest. In other words, you could get past some of this by defining some kind of compelling state interest that overrides, you know, that constitutional protection. So what is it exactly we're trying to prevent?
Mr. Chair, in the very narrowest, what we're trying to prevent is rehabilitate this statute furnishing obscene materials to minors. That's a very narrow sense. And in the broader sense, I think you are going in the right direction there. I think it's clear that if you look just at 167.065, that's the furnishing statute. It is hopelessly overbroad, but that's why you have to read that in the context of the affirmative defense statute, that if you read the two together, what you are getting at is furnishing obscene materials to minors in circumstances that are other than protected under the Constitution. That's the parental relationship, the bona fide museum, public library, school kind of activity. So you, when you put the affirmative defense on, overlay that over the underlying statute, what you have then are, absent Mr. Fidanke's jumping to his conclusion, what you have then is the furnishing of obscene materials in circumstances that are not constitutionally protected.
But I guess what I'm trying to get to is, you know, the intent of the original statute was to say that the providing of these materials to a minor had some inherent problem with it, some harm to the minor. I mean, is it that we're not articulating the harm to the minor that is the problem, or is the problem?
Mr. Chair, that is exactly the problem as far as Oregon constitutional analysis mm-hmm. is concerned, in the abstract. But the affirmative defense has a separate problem, which is that it's inherently vague.
And what bothers me, Mr. Fidanke, and where you seem to be now and talking about an interim, I don't see how you get there unless you amend the Constitution. And why that's why I'm a little surprised that apparently you want to move into
Sorry.
You take the message. Just go ahead. I'll just
it shouldn't have been on. I'm sorry.
I'm full service. I'm whatever. I'm a little confused here by both Representative Shelley and yourself, who I have immense respect for. Why, given the problems we've had with the Oregon Constitution, depending upon your view, you know, this issue, why that is not something you're not talking more about if we're going to make a run in this area?
Mr. Chair and Senator Courtney, with great respect, I can't believe I've never said that in all these sessions. We don't believe a constitutional amendment is necessary to deal with this area of the law. Number one, in State versus Henry, the Oregon Supreme Court made it very clear that they were talking in that case about material that was passed between consenting adults. And they left open the possibility of regulating materials furnished to minors. I think it's somewhat tricky to do. I think it has to be done in a way that, on the one hand, is not overbroad, and on the other hand, that is not vague. I think the easiest way to do it that will clearly pass muster under the Oregon Bill of Rights is to link the furnishing of the material to a prohibited purpose on the part of the person who furnishes the material. The most recent draft that the House Judiciary Committee was looking at, which was drafted by learned counsel, the -4 amendments, included one count where there was the purpose of predisposing the child to engage in unlawful sexual activity as a Class A misdemeanor, to have a separate offense, which would be a Class B misdemeanor, of merely furnishing the material. I think it is very much an open question whether or not that second option would fly under Article 1, Section 8. But it may, and certainly the Court of Appeals decision in State versus Maynard, I think, does make that a very real possibility. Have I lost you?
What's the evil purpose? Since you said the purpose is where we get...
In the amendments that we drafted was the purpose that we understand the statute is used for most often. In fact, it was used in this way in the Maynard case. You had... Maynard was convicted of contributing to the delinquency of a minor.
So it's delinquency of a minor, which is the goal, which is the purpose or the goal we want, or the evil we want to avoid.
Making it more likely that the minor will accept unlawful sexual advances at some time in the future.
So now it's not delinquency, it's make it more likely that a minor will accept unwanted sexual advances. So that is the ultimate, those are the ultimate words in evil, not delinquency. You've just given me the ultimate words.
Well, the definition of unlawful sexual activity in Chapter 163, it would basically include any sex crime involving a minor. Except unless it's within a three-year
age. Wait a minute. No. See, you've jumped. Don't do that.
I'm sorry.
No, don't do that. I'm not. I didn't go to Stanford. Don't do that. I want to concentrate on the child. The child, Mr. Verdanky, and you just jumped. The wrongdoing there was the adult.
Exactly.
But it's the you want to make the child, you don't want to make it more likely the child will accept unwanted sexual advances. The child doesn't commit a sin or a crime by doing that. So that's the adult. So
exactly.
So then you jump to the adult again. What the evil, though, are the words you just spoke. Is there an additional evil? You went from delinquency means the world. You narrow it now to unwanted sexual advances. Is that it? In terms of the child is the focus, not the adult who we're going to clobber if they do. Do you understand what I'm asking you?
I think I do, Mr. Chair and Senator Courtney. We believe that if the statute is limited in that way, it will almost certainly withstand a constitutional attack. There are those, including the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, who believes that furnishing any of this material to a minor in and of itself constitutes a harm which may be prohibited under the Constitution.
But you respectfully disagree with that?
We believe that that is less likely to be upheld, but maybe within the bounds of the Constitution. And again, we believe the Dash 4 amendments that the House was working on are very close, would be a much better way to go if this committee is interested in truly joining that constitutional battle, then do it with a statute that has a better chance of holding up than building on the shaky foundations in Chapter 167 currently. And that is doomed to failure, we believe.
And, Mr. Chair, I guess my point is that I think that the legislature has the right to declare as a matter of state public policy that the furnishing of obscene materials outside of the bounds of that are set out in the affirmative defense statute is in itself inherently bad. I mean, you go beyond a good purpose, a legitimate purpose to furnish obscene materials to a minor outside of the limits within this affirmative defense statute, and that it becomes problematic, I think, in many cases, if you look at the language that we were working on here, to prove that it was given for the purpose of promoting some act in the future. That becomes, we had discussion about that, is how you prove that. absent a confession or some diary entry or something like that. And so I think the policy behind the existing statute is that to move the line farther back and say, irrespective of that element of proof of what the adult intended to do by the furnishing of that, there is an element of bad to the mere furnishing of obscene materials to a child outside of the limited bounds within the affirmative defense statute. If you don't fall within that, then there is a, we are going to build a wall around minors and protect them from that kind of exposure to obscene materials. And the way we do that is we prosecute people who go around furnishing those materials outside the limitations of the affirmative defense. That's the policy, that there is something inherently bad about giving a child obscene materials for a purpose other than one that is encompassed in the affirmative defense.
All right. Looks like this discussion could go on.
Yeah,
and on.
This is wonderful stuff.
I think how much work did the House committee put into this?
Probably 4 or 5 hearings on this and the amendments.
4 or 5 hearings?
Mm-hmm. And a couple work groups.
There were a couple of work groups, and where we were moving was away from obscenity, because obscenity also includes nudity, and nudity could be something that's legitimately art, towards sexually explicit conduct as defined in RS 163, 665. That's what we left off. But I do want to remind everyone in the committee, this is a statute that relates to an affirmative defense, and it is broadening the defense. It is not narrowing the defense. It does have relationships to other statutes, which in itself are questioning the constitutionality. But this statute itself, I think that this would fix any infirmity the statute has. Am I correct?
Assuming that it could be sustained on an appeal.
On some other constitutional attack, yeah.
Right.
But that's the question for another day.
Or that the Supreme Court agrees with the analysis of the Court of Appeals. So. Okay. This is a lot of fun. Anybody want to do this?
What'd you say?
Anybody have time, energy?
Do what? I'll do it.
Like the Energizer Bunny kind of thing here? Senator,
Energizer Bunny there.
Peter Rose. I will, but please use Energizer Bunny.
Very
careful. Very funny.
All right, I think what I'll do is I'll ask Senator Burdick and Senator, whatever your name is, Courtney. Senator Duncan, if you would. To help, so we got three folks, and it's kind of a bipartisan thing.
There's two just
sit with some certified smart people, kind of bring them in, and I'll trust, because I know that Bill's been working on this stuff for a long, long, long time, to work with the group to see if there's kind of another statutory construction that we could create. It seems to me it's very, very complex discussion, because you know you do have the issue of nudity, you have the issue of those things that might be construed to be art, Michelangelo's famous paintings, et cetera, and so forth. But there is a point at which I think we may be able to articulate that certain kinds of, you know, sexual materials or obscene materials, other than mere nudity, blah, 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 you know, when given to a child, may result in some kind of harm that may sustain a constitutional challenge. But how we get there, I don't know.
Mr. Chair, if I could, one of the problems we had in the House was a relating clause. We actually had to get another bill.
Yeah, we've got plenty of bills.
Okay. Right. We probably have some good House bills with relating clause.
Hey.
Yeah. Hopefully they're not sponsored by. All right, enough of this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2415. Thank you. Are you here for another one?
I have one more.
Yes, another one.
Very
one?
Short.
2428? Now, is this a take-home bill? No. Okay. Let's do the public hearing on 2428.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Lane Shatterly, State Representative, District 34. This one, I think, is a consensus bill that comes out of a couple of amendments from the House side. It authorizes a court in a juvenile prosecution to include in the order of restitution the amount of a reward that might have been paid for the offender's apprehension. That's basically what it does. It started out as a different bill, but we worked with the Juvenile Rights Project, and I think the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association was on in this as well. and I think this gets at what we were after. This was at the request of the District Attorneys Association. I think they're on board with this, too. And again, what it does, it authorizes the court to include in the restitution order reimbursement of a for a reward that may have been offered to lead to the offender's apprehension. I don't have anything else to say.
Has this ever happened?
They can ask Dale Penn.
Really? Mm-hmm. Who else has signed up here?
What?
Dale?
Dale.
Dale, come on up, will you?
Kathy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hmm? Kathy, you're neutral on this.
My name, Mr. Chair, is Dale Penn. I represent the District Attorney Association. This is our bill. It was amended in the House side. We are supportive of it. And it's basically come out of Central and Eastern Oregon, situations where there is damage done to ranches and farms. And the rancher or farmer will put up a reward to find out who is damaging their equipment, fence lines, that type of thing. They have, lots of times, the offenders end up being juveniles, and several judges, in looking at the statutes, although there is a capability to ask for restitution of the reward for an adult offender, there was not the same grant of authority for juvenile offenders. This bill was simply put in to authorize, if the court believed is appropriate, to have the offender pay restitution to the farmer, rancher, for putting up the $200 reward or whatever it was to find out who was damaging their property. And that was our intent and the reason for it and the request, and that's why we support it.
All right. Questions? None. Kathy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Osborne, senior attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. We're neutral on this bill. I actually drafted the amendment that is, so it's the bill that is right here, because we dislike the bill as it was originally drafted. But after hearing Mr. Penn testify on the House side to hear what the problem was, it certainly seemed to us that it was reasonable that if somebody put up a reward, not knowing if the offender was an adult or a juvenile, they could get restitution if they were an adult, but could not get restitution if they were a juvenile. So that's why we came up with this amendment.
All right. Questions? Done. Work session, House Bill 2428. Senator Fire. Senator Beyer moves House Bill 2428 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? Hearing none. Carrier. Senator Beyer.
Oh.
I heard him first.
That's fine. I'm just trying to.
All righty then. Just trying to help him. Yeah?
No, it's in a work group. No.
Okay, House Bill 2351. David Groom. Sorry, no, Jim Ness, I'm sorry.
What number did you say?
2351. And this bill has a subsequent to Ways and Means. Apparently it shifts the money around.
Not noted on the...
Mr. Ness?
Do we have a different SMS than the House version, or is that just what we're working on? The same SMS?
I think we should be working on the same one. That's what I
asked. Mr. Chairman of the Committee, hopefully we are, because I did both of them, so...
Well, I just set the House one. It's set the House voting anything on it.
I did change them over, but it would be the same. I thought I did. It is the same bill. The reason for the Ways and Means referral is because it saves money for one agency but costs another agency more. So there needs to be readjusted in budgets.
Sir?
Mr. Chair, my name is Jim Nass. I serve as legal counsel for the appellate courts. House Bill 2351, and I believe the next bill that you're going to hear, House Bill 2348, were the product of a work group that convened during the interim at the direction of a budget note that was appended to the Department of Justice budget, directing that a work group examine ways to save money in the area of indigent defense. Under the good guidance of Learned High Counsel Bill Taylor, a work group did meet during the interim. That work group included several assistant attorney generals, including those that handled trial court matters, habeas corpus matters, federal court matters. It also included several staff members of the State Public Defender's Office, as well as the courts. The problem that we saw is that there were many kinds of cases in the general area of criminal law in which there is a right to seek judicial review or to appeal, but there's not much there for the court to decide. So we looked at different ways that we could reduce the cost to the system. House Bill 2351 focuses on criminal cases, particularly those cases in which the defendant has pleaded guilty or has pleaded no contest, or where the defendant is the subject of a probation revocation, or where the defendant has been resentenced on remand from an appellate court. What this bill does is it continues the right of the defendant to file a notice of appeal, but it requires a showing that the claim presents a colorable claim of error. What our hope is,
and Senator Duckett,
would you explain the colorable claim of error?
Colorable claim of error is an error that, on its face, without reference to anything else, is something that you can make with a straight face. Essentially, what it boils down to, it is not a real high standard. Because this is made at the front end of the case, before the lawyer has had a chance to thoroughly review the record, talk to trial counsel, and so on, the notion here is that counsel would do some investigation to determine whether there's anything here at all. And the reason for that is because if you look at the kinds of cases, when you plead guilty under the law, there are very few issues that you can raise on appeal. If you plead no contest, there are very few issues. So it doesn't take long to look into the case enough to know whether you have an issue. And if you do, you file your motion with the court, identify what that issue is, presumably the court will say, go forward, and everything's fine, then the case will be fully briefed and decided. What we hope, however, is that in most cases, counsel will realize that there's nothing there and be able to persuade his or her client that the appeal does not present colorable claim of error and persuade the client at that point to dismiss the case. If the client is unwilling to do that, counsel will make his or her best effort, file the motion, attempting to show whatever error it is that the client thinks ought to be raised, and the court would then have the opportunity to say yes or no. And if the court said, we don't see colorable claim of error, that's the end of the matter.
Thank you.
Counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Nass, could you give us a factual example of a colorable claim of error?
In a guilty plea, if the trial judge sentenced the defendant outside the presumptive sentence, either higher or lower, that under state law, if you plead guilty and you receive a sentence within the presumptive sentence, you cannot assign error to that. But the judge can make certain findings and impose a higher sentence. So if the trial judge imposes a higher sentence, that is an issue that you can raise. Or if the trial judge imposes restitution, that is another issue that can be raised. And I would defer to Mr. Groom as to what others there might be. Those are the two most common ones that I've seen.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Groom?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Groom from the State Public Defender's Office.
Mr. Fidanke was convinced that I was should be opposed to this bill, but actually I'm neutral on it. This does ostensibly withdraw some rights from clients that they previously had. However, it's an empty right as it exists now. The right to appeal when there's nothing to appeal is simply an empty shell. And so I think probably for the system this is a great idea. And it is also going to be of some benefit to the attorneys in my office, because our present breakdown is something like 2,000. We have 2,000 appeals roughly per year. And of those 2,000 appeals, about 1,000 of them are, or 900 or 1,000 are from guilty plea and probation violation, no contest pleas. And in the vast majority, there's nothing that we can do about these particular, there's no help we can give. And it's a waste of our time. So we would prefer to spend our time on cases that matter to our clients. Senator Duncan, if I could try and answer what is a colorable claim, and I think Mr. Nass has sort of started on that as well. I remember when I first started, before there was, there's now a procedure which allows us to get out of a case without having to make an argument. It's called State versus Balfour. And before that, when I was just starting as an attorney in this office, we would get cases from somebody who pled guilty and then had gotten sentenced to like 3 months probation. And we were supposed to do something with these cases. And so what we did was we had a form brief that we filed in every case like this, where we would say that the sentence imposed was cruel and unusual punishment. And so we would say three months probation is cruel and unusual punishment. It didn't pass Mr. Taylor's laugh test right there, and is not likely to pass too many laugh tests. The only additional point that I would make about what's colorable is that in addition to having an actual issue of merit to raise, there also has to be an objection by the defense attorney and a ruling by the court. Otherwise, there's no colorable claim. So we get a large number of cases where we can probably go through a transcript and find that there's some error, perhaps, but because there's no objection by the trial attorney and no ruling by the court on that issue, it's not appealable. It's actually a post-conviction issue, which is where these cases will go now if this passes.
All right. Mr. Chair, if I could add just, I appended some data to this, and I wanted to mention some of those because it adds on to what Dave just said. Criminal cases make up about 50% of the Court of Appeals workload. In the last year, in the year 2000, the last full year that we have, 43% of the time the attorney filed what Dave has referred to as the Balfour brief, and that which means that the lawyer was not able to find any meritorious issue to raise. During that same year, the Court of Appeals affirmed without opinion 46% of those criminal cases. With respect to guilty plea cases, 94% dismissed or affirmed. No contest cases, and this is from 1993 to March of 2000. No contest pleas, 100% were either affirmed without opinion or dismissed. Likewise, with respect to probation violation cases, as you can see, most of the time there is not enough here to make it worthwhile to go to full briefing, oral argument, and a decision by a three-member panel of the court.
All right. Questions? Work session. Yes, I do.
So moved.
All right. Senator Byer moves that House Bill 2351 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion. Any objection? Hearing none. So public hearing. House Bill 2348. And goes. And Jim, are you the primary on this?
I think I'm the designated victim on this one, too.
You got a code of the claim,
so it's become victim status.
Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Nass, legal counsel for the appellate courts. House Bill 2348 was the other shoe that dropped as a result of the interim work group. This bill focuses on judicial review of Board of Parole orders. And it has a kind of a long and sordid history. Most of you have been around long enough to remember the old indeterminate sentencing, where a defendant, if found guilty of a felony, normally would be sentenced to an indeterminate sentence equal to the maximum sentence for that charge. The Board of Parole, pursuant to its matrix that took into account severity of the charge and the person's criminal history, would then assign a parole release date, and that was a firm parole release date that the person could expect to be released on parole. However, the board had the authority to postpone that parole release date if various circumstances were present in that person's case. And the court and the board would have that authority to postpone for two-year increments. If the board postponed an inmate's parole release date, the inmate had the right to seek judicial review. Petitions for judicial review were filed in the Court of Appeals, and the person was entitled to be represented by Mr. Groom's office. After some time, we noticed that, similar to criminal cases, there was an extraordinarily high rate of dismissals or affirmances. Now, as I recall, during a four-year period of time, the Court of Appeals only wrote a published opinion in four of hundreds of these cases and had never reversed the board, which I think reflects an appropriate deference to the board making difficult decisions of when an inmate is suitable for release. But that led to proposals to reduce the kinds of cases in which an inmate could get judicial review. There was one bill, I believe, in 1993 and a second one in 1995 that severely restricted the kinds of cases in which an inmate could get judicial review. Well, in the annals of bills with unintended consequences, those were doozies. What we overlooked is a doctrine called the separation of powers, which is a doctrine under our Constitution that one branch of government cannot exercise the function of another. And one of the variations of that is that the legislature can assign to an administrative body the authority to decide the rights and duties in individual cases, but at some point there must be meaningful judicial review of that administrative case. The inmates, being the clever fellows and ladies that they are, realized that the writ of habeas corpus was a way to get judicial review. Habeas corpus would lie because their claim is that but for the board having erroneously postponed their parole release date, they would be out of prison. That had a number of collateral effects. Number one, habeas corpus cases are filed in the circuit court in which the inmate is confined in prison. Number two, the person is entitled to court-appointed counsel. Number three, the defendant is the jailer, the person running the facility in which the inmate is found. So instead of all these cases being filed in one court of appeals, they were dispersed throughout the various circuit courts. We had court-appointed counsel at that level. Frequently there was a hearing, oftentimes a short hearing, but nevertheless a hearing in circuit court. And invariably, when the inmate lost, or frankly whoever lost, the case would come up to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals would hear the case anyway. So what the result of the 1993 and 1995 legislation was, so all these cases end up going through a second forum, and everybody incurred money. The trial courts had to hear cases that they didn't formally here. Indigent defense had to pay for counsel at a new level. Attorney General's office had to pay for their lawyers to handle these cases both at the trial and the appellate levels. So, and then to make matters worse, at about the same time, the board interpreted a statute that had always given it the authority to postpone an inmate's parole release date if it found that the inmate was affected by a severe emotional disturbance that rendered the inmate dangerous to the community, and began postponing significantly more parole release dates. I don't know how many of you have seen that movie called Perfect Storm, where all these unusual atmospheric events coalesced into one event and caused this enormous storm with disastrous results for the crew of a fishing boat. But that's essentially what we had here. We had all these different events converge and drove hundreds of these cases into the circuit court and incurred far more costs than we needed to have. So what this bill would do is this. It would restore direct judicial review of parole review cases to the Court of Appeals. It would restore to the Public Defender's Office the task of handling those cases. That's the first thing that this bill does. The second thing that it does is similar to the previous bill. It would require the inmate to file a motion showing that there is something here. We have a somewhat higher standard for this kind of case. We're asking that the inmate show that the case raises a substantial question of law. And the last piece is that if an inmate, even after it being advised by counsel that the case does not raise a substantial question of law, insists on going forward with it, it would authorize the court at the end of the case, if the court found that the case didn't even raise a colorable claim of error, to impose a sanction of $100 for the Attorney General's costs and fees. It's a nominal amount, but it's an amount that we believe will get their attention and serve to further persuade them to drop those cases that have no arguable merit. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Groom?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Groom from the State Public Defender's Office in support of this bill. I think this is a good bill for the system. It does restore to judicial review a large number of cases that are taking up a lot of time in a place that's probably not appropriate for them. I would say that I'm a little bit frightened of the impact on our office. This bill will restore about, I think the estimate was 200 to 240 cases to that we don't have any attorneys for at this point. And in the House, one attorney was added to our staff in order to process these cases. Because of the language, the substantial claim or substantial question of law, and the motions that we'll have to file in order to comply with that, I'm fearful that one attorney may not be enough. And I would love it if this committee or some more perhaps appropriate committee ways and means would invite us to come back to the emergency board if we're not able to cope with the caseload. But that's the only reservation I have about this.
Okay, help me understand this. Where does your caseload come from? Why do you end up having more cases?
Mr. Chair, most of our cases are direct appeal cases that come from circuit court. We handle a small number of parole cases at the present time, mm-hmm. and so this would add approximately 200 to 240 cases that we don't currently handle to our workload.
I'm confused. I might be able to tell by the look on my face, but I thought we were streamlining the system.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I think we are. Currently, however many number of cases there are, begin in circuit court. And they get a lawyer there, they get a hearing there, they get a transcript there.
And that's they're already convicted. They're in prison, right?
Right.
They file a habeas corpus right. motion, whatever, and it goes to circuit court.
Right. Right. And then if they lose, mm-hmm. they appeal to the Court of
right.
Appeals, where they get another transcript of the circuit court hearing. case is fully briefed to the three-judge panel.
And this changes it to do what again?
It takes out the circuit court. Circuit court's gone. The lawyer's being appointed there, the hearing's there, all that's gone.
So, but didn't counsel get appointed in the circuit court?
Mr. Chair, counsel, what had been appointed in circuit courts to the habeas corpus and then for whatever appeal came after that, so there could be several levels.
But then they're not going to be appointed for the circuit court, correct?
Correct.
So isn't there some savings there?
Yes.
Okay.
And that will come to, then the cases will come to our office, and there will be some increase in our budget as a result.
Okay, so rather than going to circuit court where you're already incurring some expense, then the cases are going to directly go where? Help me understand this.
Goes to the Court of Appeals.
So we're bypassing a step.
Correct.
But you guys were already involved in the first place. We're just cutting out a step, so.
No, Mr. Chair, we were not involved in these cases to start with. Well, going back many years, this is how the system worked. We used to get these cases. And then there was a Court of Appeals, Supreme Court decision that changed that. We didn't get these cases anymore, not since 1995. Yeah.
So who got them?
That's when they started going to the habeas, to the circuit court.
Okay. That's kind of like a who's on first argument.
Right.
I thought when they did a habeas corpus argument, right, they do that now, right? They go to circuit court. They get court-appointed attorney. Mm-hmm.
Correct.
That's you.
No. No. That's a list that's maintained by the Indigent Defense Services.
All right.
Nobody in our office handles those.
And who are you?
I'm with the state public defender.
It's appellate.
You're the appellate.
Appellate defender.
All right. That's the difference. So it's not the general public defender budget. This is the appellate.
Correct.
Public defender budget. So we're moving money from one pocket to the next pocket. What you're suggesting then with the budget request issue is you would like to make sure that transfer happens.
Correct. And I think it's set up to do that, Mr. Chair, from the House side. And it will save money based on the figures that we've
had. This goes to waste and means, too, by the way.
Correct.
$400,000
savings.
Does everybody understand this just about as deeply as I do?
I think, Mr. Chair, what the fiscal will show that during the first biennium, there is not a net savings because we have all those cases that are already starting in circuit court that have to work their way through the system. And on top of that, then we'll have Dave's office handling the new ones. But the second biennium should start showing a significant savings because all those cases that are in the pipeline will be gone.
Okay. For Senator Metzger. Excuse me, Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. According to the fiscal, it says 0305, the savings would be in excess of $400,000. But I was wondering, Davis, in terms of the workload, if we look at these things in aggregate, I mean, if 2351 passes, because your comments are that the workload for the public defender would decrease by about 5%. So, and I don't know what 5% is equal to, but that might compensate for some of the changes here, assuming both were to pass as desired. It might compensate for some of that increase in workload versus the 5% decrease in workload here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, yes. I think that there's going to be some adjustments because of both bills, and it could equal out. It could be that this one requires a bit more because it's a different kind of appeal than we normally handle. It could require a bit more, at least at the beginning. But I think when you have these cases centralized in a central agency, you have a tendency to build up an expertise as to what works and what doesn't. And that may be the problem keeping it in habeas corpus is right now, is that these attorneys are all on an appointed list. They're not part of any central agency, and they kind of tend to reinvent the wheel every time they do a case, whereas we can possibly find some ways to find shortcuts.
Thanks. Okay, everybody clear? Diane Ray, do you have anything to add? You want the budget request issue handled too, right? You're all for that, right? It's going to go to Ways and Means.
Sure.
You know. And Christian, same thing?
Most people don't want things to go to Ways and Means.
Philip, I can't read it. Cradle? Same thing.
Yeah, I do have written testimony I'd like to do with it.
All right.
And
any other issue?
30 seconds worth of brief comments, if I may.
You bet, sir.
Chairman, it's members of the committee. Philip Schradl, Special Counsel to the Attorney General. We participated in the work group, and we support this bill wholeheartedly. What I think, I'm hoping that it's clear to you at this point in time that by eliminating the circuit court process, we are looking forward and the forward biennia is saving approximately $450,000 in overall system costs. That's generated by the loss. You know, we don't need to have Attorney General time, indigent defense counsel time, the circuit court judicial system's time expended at that trial court proceeding. The expenditure of funds that I think was a little bit confusing in understanding and talking with Mr. Groom, I think that's cleared up now, but just to reiterate, Mr. Groom's office currently isn't involved in the habeas corpus proceedings at all. They will experience costs associated with the appellate process on direct judicial review. Those costs are already being experienced in the system, not by the public defender's office, but by indigent defense counsel. So the dollars that the public defender needs is a transfer of funds from the indigent defense account to the public defender's office. Our office should see an overall savings by not handling the trial court measures, and Mr. Nass and the Judicial Department should also experience cost savings.
And I think a lot of these are filed in Marion County, I think.
Yes, quite a few, Chair.
And Judge Abernathy and Judge Lipscomb, they ought to be jumping up and down.
Chair Menace, I think that's correct.
Okay. All right.
Session 23. Mr. Chair, I neglected to mention that we do have some proposed amendments that resulted... cutting my own throat here. These are
off the stools. We did.
These are extremely technical, and they have to do with when this bill was in the House. One of the original themes of it is that the board would not have to do a transcript of the board hearing until after the court had determined whether or not the case raised a substantial question of law. Mr. Groom persuaded us that their lawyers needed to have those transcripts. In the process of drafting the amendments that we thought were going to get that done, we left out a few. And so they're on page 8 and 9 of my written...
You don't have LC amendments for me.
We do not.
And all this would do is put in statute that they get copies of why did they go out the transcript?
Yes, it would...
It
would make clear... when they would get filed and by whom.
Can't you do that by rule?
We could do it by rule. The problem is that there's wording in the bill now that would do something a little bit different.
Oh, okay.
Chairman, if I might, those amendments have been circulated among the interested parties. Ann Christian has had them. Dave Groom has had them. I've had them. Diane Rachel of the Scroll Board's had them.
How about
and
my counsel?
Jim Ness, and we're all in agreement with him. He has not had them yet. We would.
The city council's office hasn't had them.
Yeah.
Okie dokie.
Because
those
just got developed today.
We'll close the work session. Do we get LCs?
Thank you. Yes, sir.
It is, but they can't substantially substantially amend it.
They can, Mr. Chair.
They can, but I think I'd like to see.
Mr. Chair, Ann has raised the issue of whether this can be done by ways and means.
They can with my permission, but I won't let them.
Roger. Okay.
This is a stupid tax.
Yeah. Okie dokie. Next bill. Let's see. Let's do 2444 real quick. All right, Carl Myers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Carl Myers, on behalf of the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association, House Bill 2444 allows for what are known as youth courts, peer courts, those kinds of courts that are becoming reasonably popular in some areas for dealing with low-end juvenile problems. Unfortunately, because of the short notice, we could not bring in, did not have a chance to bring in a number of people from the youth courts. Sublimity has one, I think Staten has one, and there are a number, in fact, there's one in Kaiser where I sit as municipal court judge. But this bill would then, would formally allow those and set up a process where they could be managed by the juvenile departments for that coordination. The bill is also